You're listening to highlights from One Planet Podcast's interview with Clayton Page Aldern, neuroscientist turned environmental journalist and author of The Weight of Nature, How a Changing Climate Changes Our Minds, Brains, and Bodies. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
The neurological effects of the climate crisis are those that, by definition, act on nervous systems. And we're not the only ones with nervous systems. So this is really a shared universal experience, and one that extends past the human species. This is the type of interaction that affects anything that seeks to interact with its environment, that seeks to model its environment with a nervous system, because that's what brains do. Brains model the world around them. They prevent the organism with the brain from being surprised, because if we were constantly in a state of surprise, we would never be able to get anything done. Brains need to offer us an experience of the world that is predictable. And yet, what do we know about climate change? It is a story of unpredictability. It is a story of change, right? It's in the phrase. And so as the world changes, brains must change in kind. And that is true of humans and animals alike. It really is a series of effects. And when I use the word series, you know, I mean to say a set of progressions, right? And it's also a set of various spatial scales of effect. So you can think about the extent to which a changing climate is acting on individual cells in the brain. You can think about the manner in which it's acting on behavior, right? And then you can think about the manners in which it's acting on relationships between organisms, whole societal and cultural effects. So to break those down a little more, I think it's actually easiest to start with the individual, because this is our experience, right? This is the closest we have to understanding at an intuitive level the effects in question. You already named the fact that we can experience trauma, we can experience depression and anxiety as a function of a changing climate. I think many folks are familiar with the notion of climate anxiety. That's actually not necessarily what this book is about. I'm more interested in the direct effects of a changing climate on behavior and decision making and brain health. And when it comes to the individual, like the fact that people are more aggressive in the heat. You've maybe felt this. I certainly have. I'm a little more ornery when it's 95 degrees out instead of 75 degrees out. And that is a universal shared experience, right? People and animals as well are more aggressive in the heat. They're more prone to violence in the heat. They're also less good at solving problems. We make decisions in a more impulsive manner. And so this book dives into the neuroscience of why that might be true. When you think about the cellular level, I often try to understand effects in terms of disease progression. Climate change is expanding the habitable range of brain disease vectors like ticks and mosquitoes and bats, right? And these are vectors that carry viruses and bacteria that cause brain diseases in people, in the same way that air pollution, for example, can cross the blood-brain barrier and instigate neuronal changes that lead to things like neurodegeneration, right? We're talking about micro-scale cellular level effects of environmental stress on the brain. So we've got that to worry about. And then there are what I like to think about as the cultural changes. And the reason that these are in the book as well is because culture arises from our brains. It arises from synchronicities between our brains. It is social neuroscience. And by way of example, I have a chapter at the end of the book on language loss, right? And one of the easiest ways to conceptualize this argument is by thinking of the fact that there are some languages out there in the world that have hundreds and hundreds of words for snow, right? For different types of snow. And yet, as the climate changes, some of these words fall out of use by necessity, by the fact that those types of snow no longer exist in the world, right? And so the vocabulary will fade in kind. Now, what does this vocabulary do? What does it allow people to do? It allows them to perceive the world in a specific way, right? It allows them to understand reality with a fine grain. It allows us to categorize the world. It allows us to perceive the world with a specificity that we may not actually notice with our eyes. This is actually something that we are erecting using language. And so as language fades, as vocabulary is lost, literally intergenerationally, our perception of the world is shifting in kind. And so you can see how these cultural touchstones are being lost as well. And I think that's an important facet that we're unfortunately also not paying attention to. Well, I found myself working in a neuroscience lab, which was indeed my dream job. I had just gone through graduate school for neuroscience. And there I was looking at a computer screen, modeling neural networks effectively. I was a computational neuroscientist. And it didn't seem to me that what I was doing necessarily was on its way toward capturing the essence of the human experience in which I was interested, right? I was interested in brains because this is the organ from which our rich experience of the world arises. Brains are responsible for love. Brains are responsible for sadness. And these profound experiences are those in which I sought to investigate, right? They are the experiences in which I was interested, and modeling them in the lab in a computer simply wasn't doing it for me. And so I left neuroscience with the aim of trying to ground some neuroscientific investigations in the broader world, as opposed to the confines of a computer screen. What that meant for me in practice is I went into public policy. I went into public policy and then I went into journalism, because this is where I felt the rubber to kind of be hitting the road in terms of the relationships between science and society. And I had an editor at the first magazine I worked at, Grist, which is actually the home base to which I have now returned. I still work at Grist. I had an editor who asked me, well, hey, you're a neuroscientist. Surely there is some kind of series to be written on This Is Your Brain on Climate Change or something like that. To which I was quite skeptical at first, right? Neuroscience is one of those fields that is so readily sensationalized. I mean, how many articles have you seen on the internet that start with that phrase, right? And the sensationalism, I think, doesn't always lend itself to treating the science in question with integrity. And so I was worried, in effect, about alienating my former colleagues and looking for something to write about that wasn't actually there. And yet he was my boss. And I said, okay, I'll look into it. And there was something there. And as I continued to pull at the threads of all these manners in which a changing climate is changing us from the inside out, that to me felt like my answer. That to me was the manner in which I could take the neuroscience out of the lab and think about the manners in which it intersects with society writ large and in this, you know, more intuitive, felt, expansive manner. And this book is the result of the 6 or 7 years of research that followed. I think air pollution is probably the most well understood neurodegenerative vector that we have. People have been studying the effects of particulate matter on the brain for years. And why do I care about this? Why do I write about this in my book? Well, this particulate matter, this PM2.5, the air pollution in question, it results from the burning of fossil fuels, right? So it's connected to the climate problem very intimately insofar as it is a cause of the climate problem. Air pollution, it can enter the brain effectively through the nasal nerve. You breathe it in and it can kind of hitch a ride all the way up to the brain. Various forms of dementias, the concern there is that this low-grade chronic inflammation is that which ultimately triggers some of these neurodegenerative pathways. And so there, again, you see this environmental vector kind of worming its way into us, right? Seeping, you know, kind of past our defenses, sneaking and seeping past our defenses. So we need systems in the built environment that offer people clean air, clean water, right? Access to temperate environments. And we need the built environment to allow for exposures to clean air, clean water, and temperate environments to the extent that it can. It looks like tree-lined streets. It looks like, as you suggested, walkable cities, right? All of the vectors by which we know engaging with nature can confer neurocognitive benefit, so many of them can be enhanced in our cities through careful planning decisions. People caused the climate crisis, and it will be people together who solve it. And so I do think that future generations will feel the brunt of some of these stressors, right? They're going to feel the brunt of some of this trauma. And I also think that we need to continue to bring people into the world, because it is going to be future minds in collaboration with our own that ultimately solve the problem. A decades-long effort to understand the relationship between cyanobacteria and neurodegeneration, that type of effort can't succeed unless there is a through line through the research over the decades. And that through line can't exist unless you have young people becoming scientists, young people concerned with these issues going on to work in these fields as well. And so I do think that it's going to get worse before it gets better, and that people who are born today, people who are born in a decade, are by definition going to be born into a warmer world. And yet I think it's incumbent on us to take the even longer view, to think about the future of this. And I think when you take that perspective, it's incumbent on us to protect those far future relatives. And that is going to require deeper collaboration and further thought and hard work. And it is not only going to be for our generation to solve. You know, my mother is an artist. She's an acrylic painter. And I think growing up surrounded by art and surrounded by her practice was by definition that which introduced me to creativity. And I think creativity is often just another word for curiosity. It is a mode by which we express our curiosities about the world and about our interiority. And so I think certainly exposure to art at a young age, exposure to the creative process at a young age, is probably that which afforded me a certain sympathy to those tools and those modes of exploring the world later in life. You know, when I think about the act of writing, when I think about the types of reflection that I'm doing in these pages, that is to me an act of curiosity. That is to me an investigation into questions I have about the world that I don't see answers to elsewhere, that I believe are worth attempting to think through. And, you know, I write in the book that I don't profess any kind of moral clarity here. I'm just trying to figure this stuff out. I'm trying to work through these questions on the page. We are in uncharted territory. I think it's our curiosity that's going to get us out of it.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.